This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is the time of year where it is so wonderful to eat outside. And you take that plate of food outside, and about 4 milliseconds later, you have a bunch of flies on your food. And a lot of us just get irritated and want to swat them away. But we are not Dr. Jonathan Balcom, the author of the new book, Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
I stopped when I was reading this book, roughly every 3 to 4 sentences, because I came across a fact that just blew my mind. And I got up and I would read it to my husband, and then I would go find my chair again and then get up and read it again. I finally started acting like a fly, where I was just sort of buzzing around him at all times with these animals, with these insects. How long have you been fascinated by these creatures?
Well, I'm glad you're getting a lot of exercise.
Yeah.
I've been fascinated with all animals since my earliest memories, and probably insects were among the very first to grab my fascination, because as soon as I was able to walk, I would go out in the backyard and insects are there. As per your comment about having picnics and eating outside, flies are certainly there. Insects are incredibly diverse and successful. They make up 80% of all animal species on this planet. That's just one class of animals makes up 80%. It's estimated there's well over a billion insects per human and approximately 20 million flies, although pretty hard to do the counting. But just suffice to say, they're extremely abundant and they're diverse. As I mentioned, diversity, 160,000 described species. And I say that because it's estimated by entomologists that there's probably about 5 times that many that we haven't discovered yet. And flies are the only insects to be found on all 7 continents. So they're, I think of them as kind of nature's entrepreneurs, opportunists, very successful.
Yeah, they're right up there with the tardigrade, I think. 160,000 described species, 5 times more estimated yet to be discovered. I wonder, just when it comes down to the characteristics that really come define what it is that classifies as a new species, what are the main things that biologists and entomologists are looking at for when it is its own distinct species?
Well, it may surprise you that one of the most useful assets or attributes or characteristics of a fly for determining whether it's a member of a previously described species or a new species is their genitalia. Often flies can be so very similar physically to look at, even by experts. But it probably benefits the flies themselves to have distinctive genitalia, because maybe they make mistakes as well. But if you can't lock your genitalia to the other member of the other sex, then you're probably a different species. So they have very complex genitalia. Many of them do. A lot of species cannot actually successfully mate unless the genitals rotate 180 degrees. Don't try that at home, by the way. After they
unless you
lock
can
together.
Be in Cirque du Soleil.
yeah, maybe there's the exception. But certainly the private parts of flies are very important in helping to determine what species or what family they might belong to.
Yeah, that was definitely the chapter of the most putting down the book to say, what did I just read? Rotating 180 degrees, there is a fly species with a penis the length of its body. There is a fly species where the females can trap and store sperm from multiple males and then decide which sperm they want to use to fertilize their eggs. There are fly species where their intercourse lasts upwards of 56 hours. Let's talk about that one. What is the genetic advantage? Why is it good for those flies' genes if the sex lasts 56 hours?
Yeah, that's thought to be probably a product of what's called sperm competition among males. by staying inserted into your mate, another male simply cannot get in there unless he can pull the male out or displace him. But because these genitalia interlocks in such a complex manner, that's an unlikely prospect. So one way of keeping other competing males out of the picture is to simply remain coupled to the mate. The well-known love bugs, which are actually flies, they're renowned in particularly in Florida, where they've in the past have been known to gum up car windshields because of their incredible numbers when it's mating time. They are among the record holders. I can tell you that I think it's 59 days is the record for an insect, for stick insects. But one other thing I wanted to mention, you mentioned a fly with a penis the length of his body. There's also some kinds of fruit flies who have evolved giant sperm that are up to 7 times the length of their body. It would be like one of a human sperm being the length of a tennis court. And that, too, is thought to have evolved as a means of keeping other male sperm out, because if you have this, needless to say, these sperm are not lying straight. They're all coiled up like long strands of spaghetti, and it acts as kind of a net, a webbing to block the progress of any subsequent male sperm who might enter the female.
Wow. I'm also interested in, there is, this is more about the plants in this case, but there is a plant species where the flower design mimics the genitalia of a female fly and then, you know, attracts the male fly, gets the male to pollinate that plant. The role of mimicry in nature is so important. What are some of your favorite examples of the power of mimicry? Now, in my case, this was good for the plants, but for you, good for the flies.
Well, one of the more common types is to mimic animals who stink, animals who will punish any would-be predators, such as a bird who catches a bee or a wasp is going to get stung, and that's a very unpleasant experience. So a lot of flies have evolved to mimic other stinging insects. Flies don't have stingers. Some of them bite, but you know, most of them don't, and none of them have you know, toxic stingers. So looking like a bee is a good way to avoid being preyed upon by an experienced bird who may have had a bad experience or may have just an innate aversion to bees. There are actually some labels on some honey jars that have been printed out with pictures of drone flies, which look incredibly like honeybees on the label. The company selling the honey had no idea that it was actually a fly. And of course, the great majority of consumers would have no idea either, so probably not affect sales. One other kind of mimicry I should mention is there's some flies who look just like spiders and some who look just like ants, which is a good way to avoid prey because ants are toxic or unpleasant food items for most creatures.
Going back to the flies that look like bees, of course, get the lion's share of the credit when it comes to being the world's pollinators. Butterflies get in there, the really, really cutest bird species. The hummingbirds get a lot of credit as well. But flies are powerhouse pollinators, especially that midge fly. What would happen to the world's chocolate supply if we didn't have the midge, the sole pollinator of the cacao tree?
Yeah, flies are champion pollinators and they're unsung heroes. They rank second only to bees and wasps as pollinators. And in cooler areas like Arctic and Alpine environments, they're the tops. I think the chocolate supply would probably go away because as far as is known, there's only one species of insect and it's called loosely called the chocolate midge, a very tiny little unspectacular fly who's co-evolved with the cocoa plant, and that's the only known pollinator, and it's been quite well studied. It's a devilishly difficult flower to pollinate, and so the chocolate midge, we owe a lot to the chocolate midge for chocolate. We owe a lot to flies in general for a lot of foods that we eat. You know, 90% of the world's 250,000 flowering plants are pollinated by insects. And flies, are right up there as important pollinators. And the estimated economic value of insects for pollination each year is estimated worldwide at over $500 billion.
Wow. I read in the book that some black soldier fly larvae are selling for $330 a ton. Who are the most likely people to be buying these insects?
Well, there's companies now that are starting to breed them in large numbers. One of the pluses of black soldier flies is that they eat compost, and they're incredibly efficient at translating compost, converting compost into animal protein. And so there are some companies, quite a few companies starting up around the world with facilities that are planning to crank out, you know, hundreds of millions of tons of fly larvae or maggots, albeit sterilized ones, as fertilizer, as food for livestock and this sort of thing. I discussed that in one of the chapters in my book, and it's a controversial area, but certainly it's a cheaper and more energy efficient way of producing animal protein than certainly producing livestock.
Do we run into some of the potential problems of overproduction?
Anytime you have large production, there's concerns about the efficiencies. One of the problems with our farming system in general is these monocultures. We grow huge swaths of one crop in big fields, especially in the prairie regions, the former grasslands, and those things are kind of ecological deserts for most species, but they're also bonanza for any species who specializes in that food, which is one of the reasons why we've used so much pesticides, which is thought to be one of the reasons that insects, unfortunately, are declining quite alarmingly worldwide, estimated from based on several studies that we've lost about half of all insects on the earth just numerically in the last half century. So these are big concerns about, you know, producing food for huge numbers of humans on the planet.
We're visiting today with Dr. Jonathan Balcom. He is the author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. He is a biologist and has a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior. And I read, too, that you have been very involved in the work of, you're the former director of the Animal Sentience with the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy, and sentient being, a creature that can think and feel. And you make a comment in the book that from the point of view of the animal, it is inhumane to consume an animal. But this is within an argument of eating flies. Does this mean that you don't think that insects could be sentient?
Well, that's a great question, and I wanted to get into that a little bit. Sentience, as you say, the capacity to feel, the capacity to, you know, if you're conscious and thinking, it's based on being sentient. And there's been a lot of debate over the ages as to where to draw the line between who's sentient and who isn't. And now there's pretty much no controversy that all vertebrate animals are sentient. And now there's emerging evidence that consciousness has evolved at least twice, and probably more than that, with the emergence of our awareness that octopuses and squids and their relatives are clearly sentient, even though they're non-vertebrates, they don't have backbones. And there's quite a bit of support now for sentience in insects. It may be a somewhat different type of sentience in certain contexts, but consider that the flies have an attention span, that they can get bored with the same visual surrounding, but if you suddenly change the surrounding, their little brains fire up, and they have complicated brains, they have differentiated brains, different parts for learning and memory, you know, a central complex for spatial information and organizing movement, a so-called proto-cerebrum, which connects brain regions and collects sensory information. So quite a lot of complexity inside a little animal's head. It's amazing how nature can miniaturize stuff and pack so much complexity into a tiny package. And we have, tool use in ants and digger wasps and assassin bugs. We have learning, observational learning in bumblebees. We have rational decision-making by fruit flies and this sort of thing. So there's quite a lot of evidence for that insects, including flies, have experiences. And that, of course, leads to ethical questions. I went to an entomology conference in Vancouver while I was researching the book. I know it may have been the first time they'd done this, but they had a whole session on the ethics of insect ethics. And it was very interesting discussions and topics.
Yeah, all of this talk about using tools, making rational decisions, elaborate courtship rituals that can involve even giving gifts or learning dances. And you said that we often associate this sentience with something that is a vertebrate, something that has a backbone. Why did that become where we draw that line? Is it just because those creatures are bigger and therefore easier to study?
Yeah, that's part of it. Another part, of course, is that vertebrates are easier to compare to ourselves.
Sure.
We have a tendency as a species to treat ourselves as the gold standard, the litmus test for consciousness or intelligence. Mm. And, you know, intelligence and consciousness and awareness and sensory ability and sensitivity, et cetera, varies greatly around, depending on what kind of species you're talking about. You know, we certainly have a number of things to be proud of, you know, our culture, our arts, our technology, our music, etc. But, you know, we can't smell things as well as a fly can. It can detect a recently dead body from 10 miles away.
Right.
You can't do that. We don't have the sensory sensitivity in that area. And by the way, that's a very useful fact for flies in helping to solve crimes such as murders. You know, fishes can do certain things. I wrote a book about fishes earlier, and they can do things that we can't do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, a little bit of humility, stepping back and realizing that other species and other creatures have their own abilities. But even beyond that, the fact that they are sentient, I think, gives them some moral heft. It means that we do have some responsibilities into how we treat them and how we interact with them.
Of course, the way that we are studying other creatures is coming from an anthropocentric point of view, the point of view of humankind. And therefore, we can say something that looks like us, something that moves like us. It's easier for us to see human-like qualities in those animals. Do you ever do just this thought exercise of what a dipteropathentric, I'm making up that word, I think, but from a fly's perspective, how are they going to study humans?
Yeah, I think some of them take a great interest in us, the blood seekers, you know, the black flies and the horse flies, and of course the mosquitoes, which are true flies. If we disappeared off the earth, insects in general would continue to flourish. In fact, I think a lot of them would be high-fiving each other. They would benefit from our disappearance. But of course, there are a number of species, and certainly flies, who would be very, very disappointed, considering that they collectively, humans have about 4,600 square miles of skin surface for biting insects. That would be a big loss for them. But also when we compare them to us, it's surprising some of the parallels when you consider that they have a pleasure system, well, at least the biochemistry that we have for our pleasure system, the octopamine and dopamine, for instance, compounds that are associated with pleasure. Mm-hmm. And they also have motivation. Hungry flies learn better when there's a food reward.
And
things like self-medication. You know, there are flies that self-medicate. They qualify for self-medication. Fruit flies who will ingest more alcohol if they've been parasitized by a tiny wasp. Mm-hmm. The alcohol acts as a toxin. And alcohol is very relevant to fruit flies because they eat rotting fruit, which, of course, ferments, and alcohol is a byproduct of that.
Right. And some species of flies will drink more alcoholic or fermented beverages if they've been turned down sexually.
That's right.
Met a few humans like that.
Like some of us, some disappointed man going to the bar to have a few bottles of beer.
You mentioned that we know a lot about crime solving because of fly species. Take us to your chapter about detectives and doctors. Why is the order in which flies and other insect species colonate a dead body so important to solving crimes?
Yeah, one of the most critical pieces of information towards helping solve crimes is time of death, is estimating when the victim expired. And that information can then be traced back to the location of suspects. And because of flies are extremely sensitive to the smells that of a freshly killed body immediately starts to decay. And these flies pick up on this very quickly, and they arrive on the scene usually within an hour. Well, depending on the species, some of them colonize the body much later in the process. So by looking at the species, the stage of development, and we're usually talking about larval stages here, so maggots, how much they've grown, you can get the baseline data from simply studying these species, and then you can compare what we know, our baseline data, with what we find at a crime scene. And that information has led to hundreds, certainly at least hundreds, of convictions, murder convictions, and quite a few exonerations. I describe at length a noted case in Canada. Mm-hmm. So flies are actually very useful in crime solving, and the field is called forensic entomology. And according to one expert I interviewed for the book, she said that that field has, the number of forensic entomologists in the world has doubled in the past decade. So this is not a dying art. This is a growing art.
They're useful, too, in terms of waste management. Waste, in this case, you know, being poop. They are coprophagous. Did I get that right? Poop-eating animals.
Yeah, coprophagous or coprophagous. It sounds like a Sesame Street character.
Kind of a gross one. What would happen on this earth if nothing was going after cow dung, for example?
Yeah, flies are champion cleaner-uppers. If it wasn't for their presence, we'd have huge, huge amounts of, as you say, poop and decaying bodies. You know, the average human produces about 20,000 pounds of poop in their lifetime. That's like the equivalent of the weight of three adult hippopotamuses. You know, the world would be a much fouler and more pestilential place if it wasn't for the activities of flies and cleaning up. I used to volunteer at a sanctuary for rescued farmed animals in Maryland. And I would sometimes come upon a fresh pat of cow dung, and already these so-called dung flies were dancing and running around on the surface, doing their courtship displays and fighting over mates. And, you know, and once that happens, then it's time to feed, and they clean it up pretty fast.
You mention a lot of common names for flies, and they get to be named by whoever discovers them. What are some of your favorite common names for flies?
Well, the common names are descriptive, such as picture-winged flies, which have beautiful patterns on their wings, and they display them kind of like semaphore flags while they're courting or communicating with others. But I think it's the scientific or Latin names that where the scientists get most creative, such as the blowflies, Calophora vomitoria, and Calophora morticia. These are flies drawn to dead bodies. Mm-hmm. And then there's a genus of crane flies with very long mouth parts called Elephantomia. The bee flies, named for their sounds, Apolysis humbug, and A. zizixensis. And then the Beyonce fly, who has a beautiful bright yellow abdomen, was named for the famous pop star. There are other examples, of course.
What would you name one? I guess that would have to depend a little bit on the quality of the fly itself, but do you have some in your back pocket?
I don't really, but I have a big huge textbook on all the diversity of flies, and looking through the index, you see some lovely names. One of those ones that I didn't mention is the Quasimodo flies, which have an arched thorax, which gives them a hunched back appearance. Scientists try to be logical when they're naming animals, and of course you have to do your homework and make sure you're not naming something that someone else has already named the same thing or something different. But often their own names or other people's names who they want to honor come into the names. And then often the names are reflective of certain physical attributes, such as, you know, something about the wings or the antennae and that sort of thing.
Dr. Jonathan Balcom is the author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. And it is a fascinating read. I do hope you can pick up a copy, available through Penguin Random House. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to talk now about reality TV and cooking shows. Now, imagine the stress of competing on a cooking show, complete with celebrity judges and timers and a film crew capturing your every move. Now imagine you're not told what to make, but you have to figure it out based on clues left in the kitchen. The detective and baking show genres are combined in Crime Scene Kitchen, which airs Wednesdays at 8 o'clock Central on Fox. Two contestants are originally from North Dakota. Thomas McCurdy now runs a farm in Vermont, appears on the show with his mom, Kathy Jacobson, of Devil's Lake. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Kathy, thank you for joining us today.
You bet. Nice to be here.
So, Thomas, I gather you are on this listserv, kind of like a mailing list. You responded to a call out for people who like to bake and solve puzzles. And now you're competing on a national level TV show with your mom. I'm sure I missed a couple of steps in there. Fill us in. What else happened in between listserv response and casting?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I can really remember. It happened so fast. I receive emails regularly from various casting agencies that are casting all sorts of shows for all sorts of projects, and very rarely are they of interest at all. But one came through the inbox a few months ago that was really quite vague. It just said, are you a professional baker or a skilled home baker who enjoys puzzles and solving mysteries? If so, inquire within. And so I submitted... I filled out the little questionnaire expressing interest, and before I knew it, I was on a plane on my way to meet my mom in L.A. to begin this adventure.
And your mom, Kathy, you were originally hesitant. You said no. What changed your mind?
I said, no, I don't think so. If you want to win this competition, you could probably better choose someone else, because I am not a professional baker. I slept on it overnight, and I kept thinking it's the things in life you don't do that you regret, not the things you do. And so when he called me a couple days later, he said, Mom, really, would you reconsider being on the show? Reconsidered, I'm in.
I love that. I was able to watch episode one, and Kathy, you call yourself a meat and potatoes kind of cook. And Thomas, you mentioned right away that they were looking for professional bakers or skilled at-home cooks. Thomas, where does your mom need to give herself more credit than that meat and potatoes cook line she threw out there?
Oh, my mom doesn't give herself nearly enough credit. And when we were talking about going on the show and she wasn't sure, I asked her, I said, okay, Mom, other than me, do you know anyone else in your entire orbit who knows more about baking than you do? And she said, well, no. and no, she is an incredibly skilled cook and baker, and she's always trying new recipes, making various cakes and pies and cookies and treats, and she's so skilled in the kitchen. I knew that she had what it takes. I know that she has what it takes, rather. And I would say that my weaknesses in the kitchen, or areas where maybe I don't have the most experience, would be hers. You know, my mom has this whole lifetime of countless hours spent in the kitchen making all sorts of desserts and goodies from her mother or her grandmother's recipes, from all the places that she's lived. And so I have the professional training and the restaurant pastry background, but she has this whole depth and breadth of knowledge that I do not. So I knew we'd be a great team.
And how is that working for you? Because, you know, moms are used to being the ones in charge and being the authority figure. And now here, Kathy, you have had to switch roles a little bit. You're still mom, but he is the professional. Are there some... I don't know. Are there some little hiccups there in learning to work sort of for and with instead of just being the boss?
You know, people must seem to think that the role reversal of the bossy pants is really kind of unusual here, because we got asked that a lot in California. Huh. But I had no problem at all letting Thomas take the lead on this. Thomas has all these compartments in his mind, and he's just thinking all the time, and he knows so much that I just totally let him take the lead. I had no problem at all with that.
Well, let's talk about how the show works. It's called Crime Scene Kitchen, and it airs Wednesdays at 8 o'clock Central on Fox. And, you know, the viewer at home, there are these moments where they're going to build in suspense, where they hold the shots extra long, where they turn up the music, you know, and then they're going to cut to commercial. You're not hearing any of those things. What's it like to be on set when they're building the suspense for a competition show? Thomas, you go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would say the suspense, the excitement, the drama is all very real. It doesn't feel fabricated or built at all. The timer on the clock is very real.
Yeah.
The mysteries that are thrown at us are real. And so in the moment, it's exciting. It's nerve-wracking. Time flies by. It's so much fun. But really, in that moment, when it's time to bake, I'm only focused on what's in front of us and the task at hand. And there might be a whole sea of camera people and show people right in front of me, but I'm only focusing on what I'm baking. And so it was exciting, it was fun, and I really loved it.
Kathy, do you have TV experience? Thomas has won an episode on the Food Network of Chopped Sweets.
I have no TV experience at all. You know, I used to work for a bank, and I wrote the radio ads, and I would record the radio ads for the bank. So that's as close to stardom as I have ever been.
How do you like being on this side of it?
It was such an experience. It was an experience and an opportunity that I don't think Thomas and I will ever forget. And like Thomas said, you don't need the music and the waiting to build up the excitement. For me, the most interesting time and the most dramatic time was standing on those steps and watching the different teams bring out their desserts and thinking, did we get the right one? Oh, maybe we got the wrong one. And just waiting for that mystery dessert to come out of the smoke. I mean, that was really suspenseful for all of us.
I would agree. I would echo that. You can maybe tell from watching the show that it's this big, beautiful set with six completely separate, fully equipped kitchens all sort of facing the same direction. And so the viewers and the judges can look and see everyone working at once. But in the kitchen, when we're baking, we can't see the other bakers. We can't hear them. We have no idea what anyone else is making. And so it's not until teams are called up to present their desserts to the judges that we have any idea what anyone else has made and how they've interpreted the clues. And maybe they found clues that we didn't. And so that really is probably the most fun part of the show. Yes. Seeing what others made and just evaluating our own dessert against theirs.
Let's talk about that evaluating the clue part. So Crime Scene Kitchen, yes, you are thrown into this kitchen where a dessert has been made. They don't tell you what, but there are some clues, what spices have been used, you know, how many eggshells or what have you. And then you have to look around the kitchen, figure out what's been made, and then make it. And, you know, episode one, there were, I think, six teams making five different desserts. They came to five different, mostly logical conclusions. What was your process for how to figure out these clues?
Well, I'll say going into the Crime Scene Kitchen for the first time, we had absolutely no idea what to expect. In terms of these clues, we had no idea what we were looking for. And so that was so exciting and so challenging, looking through the cupboards and drawers, the dishwasher, the refrigerator, freezer. There are bits of crumbs or flour on the counter, items in the garbage to indicate how to decorate. Or there might be, yes, one of the jars of spices on the spice rack with the lid slightly askew. And so the first step is really just finding all of the clues, or at least trying to. And then the second part of that is interpreting them, evaluating the clues to figure out which which are pertinent to this bake and which were left here to mislead us, because some of them mm-hmm. might have absolutely nothing to do with the dish that we're making. But we found both my mom and I are the type of learners in which saying it out loud will help us remember it. And mm-hmm. so we realized right away that just thinking out loud and talking to each other the whole time that we're in that kitchen, I'm seeing this, it could be this, I'm opening the fridge and here's what I find, we're more likely mm-hmm. to remember it when we walk out of the kitchen.
mm-hmm. So, Kathy, how is this experience going to change how you cook? Will it?
Oh, I think it will definitely change how I cook. Realize it's totally different when you're under the clock and when you're cooking, baking something for judges. There were a few times where I just had to start over again. I mean, yeah, my home company, yeah, good enough. But when you've got these professional judges evaluating what you're baking, you really have to be perfect. And when you're looking at the clock, you can't say, oh, I'll do that later, or I'll come back to that and reevaluate. You're constantly under the gun. But as far as my own baking, I'm going to continue to bake things that I've never baked before that are totally out of my comfort zone. In fact, I plan on having some friends over in the near future where we're just going to have a high tea and I'm going to bake all kinds of exotic things I've never baked before, just because it's so fun and so delicious.
Well, let's talk about this recipes you've never baked with before, because there's reading a recipe. And then there's coming up with a recipe, and then there's not having any idea what you're supposed to be baking and sort of making it up. Or I mean, I don't even know how that works. If somebody said, okay, looks like they made, that French wedding cake made out of profiteroles, the croque en bouche, like, now where mm-hmm. do I start? Do you, Kathy, have experience making up recipes?
You know, I am such a let's follow the recipe person. I will try any recipe. If someone says, oh, Kathy, I really love such and such, okay, I'll make it for you. I have no problem following a recipe. But that's another thing about this show. I think it's going to help me become a little bit more creative in the kitchen. Mm. And I love that. I love being able to say, okay, this is what I think would be really good. Okay, let's put it together and make it.
Thomas, do you have a Rolodex in your head, basically, of recipes?
Baking is very much a science, and so different from cooking, in which you can throw a little mm-hmm. bit of this, a little of that, and you have a salad. But with baking, it really is chemistry. You know, in pastry, we often use the word formula instead of recipe, because these are basically, you know, chemistry experiments. And there are only so many ratios and you know, formulas that one can have in their head. And so this experience was really quite challenging, but a great exercise for me in just trusting myself and trusting my gut, because when the clock is ticking, there's no time to second guess oneself. And you know, our little uh-huh. brainstorming session on the show, when we're evaluating the clues that we found in the crime scene kitchen, that happens while the clock is ticking and our bake is being timed. And so we need to decide very quickly what to make, and then we need to make it as quickly as possible. So I think for me, one of my greatest challenges, professionally and personally, is just leaving well enough alone. I'm a perfectionist to a fault.
Right. Pastry chef, come on.
Exactly. But with this experience, I had to force myself to let go a little bit and just trust myself, trust my mother, trust the process, and just get it done the best we can. And at least in episode one, it paid off.
That's not an easy mindset to get into. I mean, the skill set that got you to the level that you are at, all of a sudden it's just like, you're gone. You worked a whole lifetime to build these perfectionist skills. What do you still want to kind of hold on to?
What makes this show different than any others that I've seen is that it's not about making the best dessert or the most beautiful, most delicious. It's just about making the correct dessert. Mm. And so in the first bake of episode one, I would never, ever put a spider web on the top of a Boston cream pie or coat the sides of it with sliced toasted almonds. And so I really had to go against, you know, everything that I held near and dear as a pastry chef, and the aesthetic that I maintained, the just the types of desserts that I'm comfortable and experienced creating. I had to let all of that go and focus on, no, what's the correct dessert? Not what do I want to make, but what am I supposed to be making right now? And it was a lot of fun, and it was such a great exercise for me that I hope I can keep some of that mindset with me, you know, after the show and in my everyday life, because I could benefit from relaxing just a little bit and letting go.
In addition to being on this national TV show, you run a farm with your husband during the pandemic. You switched it over almost immediately to a delivery service of fully prepared meals, which in theory is great for a chef, but you're missing that element of seeing people. What's your next step, Thomas?
That's exactly right. My husband and I have been farming for 10 years now. We have a cut flower farm up here in northeast Vermont, and we also raise some beef, pork, and poultry just at a homestead level. And for the past 7 years, I've had a bakery operation, baking for farmers markets, doing wedding cakes, and had a mail order Christmas cookie business. And yes, it was March of 2020, the arrival of COVID, I transitioned everything over to a meal and prepared food delivery service, thinking, okay, for maybe 2 or 3 months until this COVID thing is behind us, this will be great. But then it was a year later, suddenly spring 2021, and it was still going strong. I'm so grateful that we were able to create this new business and create some jobs and feed so many people through 2020. But to be honest, I just got really tired, and it was time to step back. And you're exactly right that as much as I love to cook and bake and to create food, for me, it's really about sharing it with people and enjoying it at a table with friends and family and customers.
Yeah.
And so just making food and dropping it off on someone's doorstep, I realized wasn't as fulfilling and enriching as I would have liked it to be. So we've taken a step back, and this summer I'm just on the farm, helping in the greenhouses, raising some animals, growing veggies, and the plan is for next summer, 2022, to resume our brunch and dinner events that we have here on the farm. We have a beautiful little event barn in which we've hosted a number of events in the past. I'd love to share this space and my food and our flowers with people here on our farm. It brings me so much joy. And so we're in the process of constructing a commercial kitchen space here on the property so we can really focus on bringing people here, sharing the space, and enjoying meals here on the farm.
Kathy, that kind of approach to food can be just something someone is born with, and who knows where it came from. But in this case, it's pretty obvious that he was raised in an environment of deep appreciation for the kind of connection that can be built over food. When you're not cooking on a national TV show, what's your approach to setting the scene, creating a mood, having the food and the love and everything that you put into a meal get out there to your guests?
I love bringing people together through food. I have been working at Lake Region State College in Devil's Lake, and when I started there, it was really important to me that we celebrated everyone's birthday. Mm-hmm. And by just getting together and celebrating birthdays within the nursing department, it's just really brought that group of women so much closer together. And on a more personal level, I just love creating events for my friends to enjoy. I think that it's the ambiance, you know, whether it's a backdrop of a French bistro, which, yes, I have done, or candelabras and special invitations or menus on the table. I love to create an experience, and I think that everything together, including the food, is making memories. And I think Thomas will be the first one to say and to acknowledge that I'm constantly saying, let's make a memory. And that's what food does.
Thomas, did you get to meet the woman for whom your farm is named? Because your husband started this farm in memory of, was it a grandmother?
Yes, it was my husband's late grandmother, Ardelia. She passed away at the age of 98 about 8 years ago, and I unfortunately did not have a chance to meet her, no, but we left Philadelphia to start farming. It was 2011, and we were on rented land for a couple of years, just learning about this new life that we had chosen. And when Ardelia passed away, she remembered her grandchildren in her will, and it was that gift that allowed us to finally invest in some land ourselves and buy what became Ardelia Farm. She was a wonderful gardener and flower enthusiast and a skilled cook, baker, and hostess, and so it seemed only fitting that our food and flower-based business be named after her, and it's also such a beautiful name.
And that investment made it possible. Winning something like Crime Scene Kitchen gets a person $100,000, or I guess a team $100,000. I know you can't tell me if you won the series, but can you tell me what $100,000 would mean to Thomas McCurdy and Kathy Jacobson?
Well, I retired from my job on April 1st, and I flew to California to film the show on April 2nd. And so if I were to win my portion of $100,000, I would spend it traveling to all of the places that I have only dreamed about. I love to travel, but face it, we do not have unlimited budgets to spend traveling. That is what I would do with $100,000.
Thomas?
Yeah, so my husband and I bought our farm in March of 2014, and it's a beautiful 50-acre piece of property up here in, yeah, again, the northeast corner of Vermont. Beautiful, but it's a rickety old dairy farm that was in the same family for many, many years and then neglected for quite a few before we purchased it. And for the first several years of our time here, we invested everything that we could into the business, building greenhouses, amending the soil, buying a tractor and skilled labor. And we're finally at the point with the business and the farm that it's time to shift gears a bit and focus on the house and making things a bit more beautiful. And so we just finished tearing down a good portion of the rickety old dairy barn that was about to fall over. It just needed a little help, and we would love to be able to restore what remains of the original structure from around 1900. And our little farmhouse, we've been slowly fixing up from the inside out, and it'd be wonderful to win half of $100,000 to continue to restore this beautiful old farm.
Thomas, I think North Dakota farm. I'm thinking plaid. I'm thinking dusty boots. I'm thinking about wheat. And then I think Vermont farm, New England farm. I'm thinking more fitted clothes, and I'm thinking cheese. Am I way off on either of these?
I mean, we certainly have dusty boots and big old tractors, but I will say, yes, growing up in North Dakota, I had one idea in my head of what farms looked like. And
yeah,
that's all that I knew. And so moving to New England and being a part of this completely different agricultural landscape has certainly opened my eyes to what farming can be and is. And so our farms are much more hilly here in Vermont. We have quite a few trees, and you really need to take advantage of those little bits of flat ground that you do have. So there might be a greenhouse tucked away here or there, and a little paddock over there with a couple of cows grazing, and a cute little old barn. And it's a lot of work, of course. It's not nearly as bucolic as it looks on social media, but it is really dreamy, and it's so easy to take for granted that we really are living the dream here, and I feel so fortunate.
Thomas and Kathy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was Kathy Jacobson and Thomas McCurdy, a mother-son team competing for a $100,000 prize on Fox's Crime Scene Kitchen, which airs Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Central on Fox. You can find out more about Ardelia Farms on Facebook and Instagram.
We
we'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and this hot turn of the weather has a lot of people heading towards the nearest body of water, so why not take up some good fishing? In this week's Natural North Dakota essay, biologist Chuck Lura talks about walleye.
I recently saw a few photographs of some impressive walleye taken from the Missouri River this spring in the vicinity of Bismarck. Walleyes are undoubtedly the most popular fish in North Dakota in terms of angling interest and table fare. It might surprise some of you, but the walleye is closely related to the perch. They're in the same order and family. Fish in their order may be characterized by having a dorsal fin, that's the fin on the back of the fish, that's divided into two segments, or with a narrow connection in some species. The front segment consists of spiny rays, while the rear segments have soft rays. The family includes walleye, sauger, perch, and darters. It also includes the European zander. Some of you may remember that there was considerable interest in zander as a game fish in North Dakota back in the 1980s. As with plants, the common names of fish can sometimes be confusing, and occasionally the walleye is an example of that. Most of us know this fish as a walleye, but it's also known as a yellow pickerel, or just pickerel north of the border, and it's occasionally referred to as a walleye pike. One may infer from that the walleye is a close relative of the northern pike, which it's not. Northern pike, or simply northern or jack north of the border, is in a different order than the walleye. Members of this order, which includes the northern pike and muskie, are known for having sharp teeth and a cigar-shaped body which is good for swimming in short, fast bursts straight ahead. They're fast and fierce predators. In addition, they have their dorsal fin and anal fin set back near the forked tail. So if you hear or see reference to a walleye pike, remember that the walleye is not a close relative of the northern pike. And it's interesting to note that Garrison, North Dakota is the walleye capital of the world, and the Garrison Dam National Fish Hatchery is the largest walleye hatchery in the world. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
That's it for this Sunday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday in our afternoon time slot, we visit with beloved children's book author Linda Sue Park about her new book, The One Thing You'd Save, which explores how students think about what they have and what that means. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.